Hi, and welcome back to the Epic Experiment Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce, and this is my co-host, Lux. For those of you who are new to our cast, we are a Magic the Gathering podcast dedicated to playing Commander, but with a twist. Our twist is that we only use cards that were printed in Return to Ravnica block and forward. We do this because oftentimes restrictions breed creativity and innovation, can help improve accessibility to cards, and hopefully keep our costs down. Each week, we look back retrospectively at sets beginning with Return to Ravnica with an eye to examining the potential commanders in each set, obvious staples from each set, and some hidden gems in each set to bring new life to your decks. Each week, we'll give you guys a deck tech with an eye to inspiring you to come and give it a try. Our deck techs will look to keep the price tag under $100. That's a threshold that hopefully keeps the decks affordable for our listeners and something fun to play with your friends. We'll also cover hot topics in the world of Commander, look at other cynicals and formats as needed, and any other news that may be needed to cover. So, sit back, relax, enjoy the show. We're going to have a whirlwind ride and have fun, some fun at the same time. So, welcome to the Epic Experiment Podcast. How are you tonight, Lux? What's going on, my friend?
Not much, and just been going through in the news, and not much to talk about this time around. But there is something that we've been meaning to...
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, like, there is something that we've been meaning to talk about, and for... We were going to talk about it last week, but we didn't have enough time to fit it into the show.
Yeah, good point there with... You're right. It's been a little slow on other news, so this is a great opportunity to shoehorn that that topic in there. So our topic for our listeners today, we're going to talk about... It's actually something that's really important to players who are looking to be budget conscious. It's... Where do you buy your cards? All right. And, you know, it'd be very simple just to say, oh, I buy pop packs. But if you're a Magic the Gathering player and you have to play on a tight budget, you learn pretty quickly that buying packs and popping packs is a gigantic gamble. It's like buying a lottery ticket. And you could very easily find yourself spending far more money than you really intended to build your decks. So, Lux, I know you're a big drafter. Do you pop packs on your own unless you're drafting, or do you only pop packs when you draft?
And I only pop packs when I draft or do sealed.
Exactly. So, just as basic, like, sort of MTG Finance 101, anyone out there listening, opening packs, just for the sake of opening packs, it's bad, you know, bad money sense, bad financial, doesn't make sense. You'll spend more on your pack, and you'll very rarely get the right amount, the same amount of return back. And so unless you're going to do something when you pop packs, like draft or play a sealed or do something else with them, just something as simple as even just playing pack wars could make it, you know, worthwhile. But just opening packs for the sake of opening packs is usually a recipe for spending more money than you're ever meant to. However, it's an interesting time right now to buy cards, because if you've been listening to other people who are far more in tune to Magic Finance than we are, the prices on Theros Beyond Death are just crashing. And maybe now is the perfect time to be buying some spicy treats from the latest set to make your deck super cool, or to buy some of those great new looking lands from the Constellation lands. I guess they're full art and they're gorgeous. What do you think of those lands, Lux? Do you like those guys?
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Yeah, I think they're pretty sweet. And I think really Wizards has upped their game the last sort of couple of years with some really nice full art land offerings. So if you're looking to make your deck look kind of nice without spending a small fortune, these lands are pretty interesting. But this is kind of an aberration. Not every set goes down the drain the way Theros is. Meaning that prices tank. A lot of times sets behave a little bit differently. So we've got some tricks and tips to help you guys stretch your dollar, keep your costs down, and make you guys manage your bottom line just a little bit better. So let's start with where to buy cards. Lux, let's talk about where do people buy cards. What do you think?
And most of the time when I see people buying cards, it's usually from the LGS, the local game store.
Yeah, that's sort of like level zero. You're buying them from a store. And my experience is the same thing. Most of the time, if I'm buying packs, I buy them from a store. most notably NLGS. Sometimes I order them online. Here in Canada, the big store to order online from, if I order a box or something to draft with my friends, I order from Face to Face Games or the Wizards Tower here in Ontario. I know in the United States, a couple of the big vendors, you know, people might always hear about Card Kingdom, or you hear about Star City Games, or you hear about Channel Fireball. There's lots of other really great vendors too. But sometimes it's just as simple as going down to your local game store. You work at one, right, Lux? Do lots of people come? You must have lots of traffic through your place.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so that's probably level, I call that level zero. You go into a store, maybe there's a level minus one here that's even more basic. We could go into Target or Walmart and buy cards. I don't know, like, what's the situation with Walmart? Like, does Walmart undercut you guys at your LGS there, Lux?
And actually, no, when I've had people come in and say that we are more in a, like, we are cheaper and more affordable in our product than Walmart is.
Yeah, I mean, here in Canada, that tends to be the reality here as well. I think it has something to do with how they stock things through a third-party distributor rather than Walmart doing it directly. But that's nice to hear. And I hope players out there are going to go buy their cards from a local game store. Support that local game store, because that's sort of a hub in your community to get you. They often provide game space, or they host pre-releases or fun events. So anybody out there who's buying stuff and looking to buy cards, please, 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 if you can, go and support your LGS. And I'm not talking for any particular LGS. Just if you have one near you and you're looking to buy cards, go down there, take the extra 5-10 minutes out of your way and go and buy from them rather than going into Walmart or the Target or whatever big box store and buy your cards there. The LGS is going to be infinitely more appreciative of your patronage. And they do things for the Magic community that, you know, extends beyond just buying cards. How often do you guys run events at your store, Lux?
Yeah, and like every couple of months, like we run a special event soon, not just pre-releases, but we also have it on like game day. And my LGS actually brought back Sealed League.
Oh, that sounds like fun. So yeah, like people, like if you're out there, go and support your LGS. They're gonna end if there's something you want to do at the LGS in terms of like a tournament or an event or something, talk to them and see what they're offering. I bet they've probably got something that you hadn't been anticipating. So that's like level zero, going to a store like an LGS or even an online vendor and buying your stuff. Level one, like sort of the next level up in terms of complexity. And something you have to be a little more careful about is going to TCG Player. All right, so one of the hitches with going to an LGS, particularly if you're going to go buy singles, or if you're buying them online from Star City Games or Channel Fireball, you may not always be getting the best price because these stores have overhead that they need to keep the lights on. So prices may be a little bit higher then, you know, you can find online. Probably not outrageous. And you're probably rest assured that you're going to get that card because those guys really want to keep their reputation. TCG Player, vendors on there can be a dude in his basement who's got no overhead except for, you know, whatever TCG charges him to sell his cards. So he can probably get away with putting things on online that are cheaper than you might find on a major vendor. The only hitch you run into with TCG Player is that sometimes not everybody on TCG Player is as, let's say, above board as they ought to be. So they may, you know, cancel an order, may not send you quite the level of grading that you anticipated. The condition, like, so card condition may be a question. So there's a bunch of different sort of little things that you have to be mindful of. And I know people who use TCG Player regularly, you know, are looking for the reputation that people have on the platform. How many sales have they made? you know, how many interactions that they had. So that sort of stuff does matter on TCG Player. I'm going to be very, very honest. Living here in Canada, buying from TCG Player is not a thing for me. I know some Canadian player, some guys do, but you need to have somebody in the United States to help you out with that, because trying to have them mail directly to Canada, there's going to be a lot of additional fees that ratchet up the price quite a bit. So it's a little bit tougher for people like me in Canada, but I know in the United States, the system works great. There's lots of fantastic vendors out there vending on TCG Player. You can find lots of great cards. So, you know, it's definitely something worth exploring if you are interested in saving yourself some money to make sure that you have the extra pocket money that you want to spend on that cool deck that you're brewing up. What about you, Lux? Do you use TCG Player or do you use other platforms?
And I've used TCG Player a couple of times, but there's one that I use more, and I'm about to talk to about that. Like, it's called Miniature Market.
Oh, yeah? So tell me a little about Miniature Market. I'm not really familiar with it, so explain it out a bit, would you?
And I first discovered this website a couple of years ago. I was going around looking for singles, and like we've been talking about, there's a certain card I was looking for that no one else had, but they had it. And I noticed that when I went on there, like, it was at a reasonable price.
Well, that sounds good. That's a good starting point.
And see, and when I went to go check out, there's something I noticed. Something that they do differently from other sellers.
Oh yeah, what's that?
When it comes to shipping singles, they have a 99-cent shipping fee.
Okay, that sounds pretty. That's pretty reasonable. I mean, that would be amazing here in Canada. I think that 99 cents sounds pretty reasonable. Now, how many cards can you ship at that price if you're buying singles? Like, is there a point where your package is big enough that they charge you more than 99 cents?
You know, see, like, that's the downside, though. That you could only ever have four cards shipped at a time.
Oh, okay. Well, depending on the cards, that's not the end of the world. So that's not bad. I kind of like that fixed price of 99 cents. So you've ordered a bunch of expensive cards, they'd still be 99 cents versus, anyway, that sounds pretty reasonable. So, but yeah, so that's another good avenue to explore. So again, players out there, if you're listening, listeners, I suggest, like, explore some of these avenues. Don't just assume that because you want to buy a card, that you end up having to go to, you know, Channel Fireball or Star City Game or Card Kingdom. There are lots of vendors out there, lots of places to buy cards, and lots of them are going to be at very reasonable prices. You just got to be aware and alert to things that may tip you off that whoever you're dealing with on the other end may not be entirely above board. But Miniature Market sounds like a good option, and lots of vendors on TCG Player are great options. So well worth the time to explore, but do your research first. The last one that I sort of talk about is, should I call it level two? And this one, there's inherently quite a bit more risk on it, is buying cards through Facebook or Twitter or other social media platforms. And it's kind of like the Wild Wild West. Now, the nice part about it is you can find some really terrific deals out there, because these sellers really do have zero overhead. They're not charged fees for you know, selling cards the way vendors on TCG Player are. But you really, really are essentially doing it on the honor system that you pay them and they are going to send you the card. Now, I have you know, on a few occasions bought cards, typically through Twitter, more so than on Facebook, but there are lots of Facebook groups, like MTG Sick Deals is one. There's like a high-end group that you can buy and sell some very expensive cardboard there too. On Twitter, the hashtag MTGBuySell has got lots of different listings for people looking to sell cards. And I've had quite a bit of success with the Twitter sales too. And most of those vendors, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, are pretty good about wanting to get you your card and get it to you in the condition you want because they want the positive reputation. That's what they need more than anything. And don't be shy to ask for references for people if you're buying on these social media platforms. Ask, hey, I need a reference for so-and-so. Is he good? And you'll probably get a bunch of people, you know, giving you a thumbs up or say, yeah, they're great. Now, there are guys out there that are scamming people and you hear about them and it makes you sick to your stomach. But I found that most of the people who are posting things on Facebook or Twitter are, you know, 100% above board and looking to do business and move their cards without the overhead. So you can get some good deals. But do your research, ask for references, find out about who these people are. But you can find some really good deals on there. You won't be disappointed. And because you're dealing with them directly, you can probably even negotiate a little bit. They've got some wiggle room. So, have you ever bought or sold on Facebook or Twitter there, Lux?
And not those specifically, but there are other social media platforms. And ever heard of MTG Amino?
I have not. I think I did once upon a time. Well, it used to be an app that I had on my phone. And there was a bit of a buy and sell feature there, wasn't there?
Yep.
Is it still active? I'm not familiar with how active it is.
And it's still active.
Cool. So have you bought and sold there?
And a couple of times. And I actually have the trusted trader role.
Cool. So again, same sort of thing though, that the references is a big deal. And making sure that people are, you know, exactly what they're saying that they're going to sell is important. All right. So now that we know where to buy cards, whether it's a store or a TCG player, or you're looking on social media, what exactly are you going to buy? And I have a couple of pieces of advice. I know Lux has got some different advice too. So my first piece of advice for you guys, if you're commander players and you're looking to build decks, MTG Finance 101 for commander players. If you're going to go buy a card, so let's say you're going to go buy Nylea's Intervention from Theros Beyond Death. You should really be looking at picking up not just one, but picking up two. And here's the reason. So it's a thought theory sort of coined by Jason Ault. And if any of you listen to Brainstorm Brewery or check out EDH Rec, you're reasonably familiar with him. He's pretty out there. He's pretty involved in the content community, and I have to give him full credit for this sort of EDH theory. And you don't even have to be big into finance. Just if you're going to go buy a card, grab a second one. The reason being is that someday, if that card you have in your hand spikes in price because people find it's awesome with their sweet new commander, or they decide they want to play it in Pioneer or what have you, then, you know, you have a copy for your deck and you can sell the second copy. And heck, maybe that spike will pay for, you know, essentially you got the first copy for free. The other piece that, you know, invariably will come up is that you're going to build a deck and you're going to say, geez, I wish I had another Nylea's Intervention. Well, now you've got one in your box. Just open it up, put it in your deck, and you don't have to worry about it. So it'll save you the grief of having to go find one later. So this sort of simple advice has been really handy to me, where I've had a bunch of these cards that I'm looking to pick up, and instead of grabbing one, I'll grab two. And sure, it, you know, may cost an extra $2 at the time, but at the end of the day, you know, when I have, if that card should ever spike, or if I want to use it in a deck, I've already got a second copy. It's not a problem to go get one. But what do I prioritize when I'm buying cards? The first thing I always prioritize is lands. So a great example right now in Theros and Eldraine being the two most recent sets that are being printed, the castles, so the rare castle cycle from Eldraine and the temple cycle from Theros are things that I would be looking to pick up and sock away in my box of EDH stuff, because I think they're all going to be really applicable at some point down the road. You know, even Castle Embereth, which is like sort of the red one, is going to be great in some sort of a goblins deck. You get to have a chance to pump your goblins or your mono red creatures and smash for extra damage. You know, all that stuff is going to be fantastic for, you know, a red deck. Or Castle Lochthwane is like the obvious one, which is why it's getting expensive. But even Castle Ardenvale or, you know, whatever, they're all good. They're all going to be useful. You're all going to be thankful that you have them. And same with the temples. Like, they're not exciting lands to base your deck around, but they produce two colors of mana, and they come with a scry, which is a relevant ETB. So, yeah, like, I think you could not go wrong with buying and hoarding a bunch of these lands right now while they're cheap. Because invariably, if things do spike, the shock lands, for instance, or the fast lands from Kaladesh, like, these things are quite a bit expensive, quite a bit more expensive, and your deck is going to, the price tag is going to balloon. So grab them early when you can, or grab them when they're cheap, or, you know, whatever you need to do. Do you prioritize lands there, Lux, or you just sort of grab them as you find them or need them?
And normally, and I get my lands from the supplemental products, you know, like fat packs or in like pre-constructed decks. But like, when I'm out and shopping, what I'm doing is grabbing cards that I actually need for decks that I want to build.
Okay, so we'll get to that in a second then. I prioritize artifacts there, folks. Artifacts to make mana. I also prioritize equipment and things with pretty unique effects. So Chromatic Lantern would be the sort of mana rock that I'd be looking to, if I can grab them while they're cheap, I'll do it. So I got a bunch after Guilds of Ravnica was released last year when they were around $5. Right now they're somewhere between $7 and $8. So, you know, I've already saved myself $3 a copy. And, you know, while that may not sound like a lot, if you have to buy one or two or three of these things, you know, if you buy three extra copies of Chromatic Lantern, you spent almost $10 extra. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with grabbing them early when you can, if you're getting them for cheap. Equipment, a great example of a piece of equipment that I think is going to be very useful in our format is a Sword of Sinew and Steel, which is one of the swords from Modern Horizons. I think this is the sort of card that just sort of goes universally in a bunch of decks. The protection from black and red is relevant. The +2/+2 is relevant. The blowing up of Planeswalker or an artifact is relevant. They're all good abilities, and picking them up makes sense. Or interesting effects that you really can't recreate. So a great example of this that are recently printed are Helm of the Host and Panharmonicon. I was going through a box of cards that I have, and I was not aware, but apparently somewhere I picked up six Panharmonicons at various stages, because apparently I can't get enough of those things. I also look for unique cards, like for instance, cards that flip or transform, interesting sorceries, things that are templated in a way that makes them conducive to Commander. So flip cards, like things from Ixalan. So Dousing Beggar is a great one that I will talk it up every chance I get. Because sure, on the front side, it's a kind of a useless little artifact that gives it's equipment that gives your creature +2/+1 or something. Your opponents get 2 plant tokens, and it's kind of annoying. But if you can put it on an invasive creature and transform it, you get a land that makes 3 mana. And that doesn't sound that powerful, but we're seeing with Lotus Field, the ability to make 3 mana out of one card is super busted in a bunch of formats. So don't discount any land that will make more than one land, like more than one mana, because they're all very useful, and you're going to find that if you can exploit that ability in Commander. And the last but not least, I prioritize creatures. I'm not really looking for creatures, because there's so many creatures that are printed each and every set that are so good that they're sort of interchangeable. But there are some that are essentially so good that you have to really look at them. So last week we talked about Prime Speaker Zagana, and progenitor mimic being something that is, you know, unmistakable house in your deck. Like, you have it, your opponent has to answer it, or it's going to get silly very quickly here on the table. In Lux's deck from 2 weeks ago, we talked about Tristani. Well, Voice of Resurgence might be the sort of, you know, inexpensive value engine that you really might want in your deck. So there, it's probably the best straight up two drop that green white has if you're looking to make tokens, because it can do so much. It's got a death trigger. It's so useful. Or if you're playing like a Rakdos deck, something like Master of Cruelties, which is from the set we're reviewing today, is sort of the card that, you know, we're talking about. It's just awesome card quality. Or I'm looking for things that synergize really well with my commander. So, like, example, 2 weeks ago, Lux's green-white deck, Tristani Summoner is not the sort of card I would normally be prioritizing in my decks. But if I needed one, I'd be sure to pick one up. It's probably pretty cheap. Because it synergizes, it does exactly what Lux's deck wanted to do, make a whole bunch of tokens. And this week, you know, last week with my Zagana deck, Varel of the Hulklade was exactly the sort of card that I'd be looking at to grab in from Dragon's Maze to go in my deck. So that's what I prioritize when I'm going to buy cards. And sure enough, there may be things that I've missed, counter spells or other things, but this is the sort of template that I have when I go and find cards for my decks. Lux, you were telling me you do something pretty different, though. What do you start looking at?
Yeah, mainly when I start brewing a deck, I think of, what do I want this deck to do? What is the theme? The play style? And like we've been doing with these decks that we've been building, tokens, +1/+1 counters, like graveyard, as we're about to get into, I start looking for cards that synergize, that fit in that theme.
Absolutely, that seems like a wise strategy. So you're sort of looking at cards that, as you need them, you grab just what you need, rather than the approach that I take, where I grabbing a big selection of things, and I will find a use for them later, even if they're not right away going in a deck.
Yeah, because one card I recently picked up, and during my search in deck building, remember 2 weeks ago we were talking about board wipes in EDH.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and I recently picked up a couple copies of one card that would definitely fit right in a token deck, and basically just stop all those board wipes in their tracks.
What's that?
Avacyn, Guardian, Angel of Hope.
So is that the original version of Avacyn, or is that the one from?
It's the original version of Avacyn. They makes all your permanents indestructible.
Oh yeah, gotta love her. She's great, isn't she? It's unfortunate she's $25 a card or whatever, but yes, very cool.
Yeah, and she may be expensive in price wise and in converted mana cost, but there are cards within this format that can help with that.
Absolutely,
especially in the tokens deck.
Absolutely. If you can find ways to use Cryptolith right to caster, then you're laughing all the way to the bank, my friend. Yeah, I agree. So, yeah, no, I see your point that sometimes the strategy of just picking up what you need can be very useful. And, make sure that you're spending your money on a deck that you want to build right now, rather than, my approach, which, it's probably saved me some money in the sense that the cards that, when I go to use them may cost more if I were to buy them right there. But I've got, they've been hanging around in a box for a while. So, absolutely. I think both strategies have merit. And I think that, either way, we have a plan when we go to build a deck. We're not just buying whatever we see and spending our money willy-nilly. You have a plan. I have a plan. And I think it's important that you have a plan and you stick to your plan, whatever that plan may be, to try and make sure you stretch your dollar as far as you can. It's the player who doesn't have a plan and then just buys lots of whatever that is spending far more than they really ought to. Do you agree, Lux?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So have a plan there, player, for their players. Have yourself a player, a plan. I mean, all right. So then there's a question of when. When do you start looking for these cards? Now, if you're Lux, you might be you need them for your deck, and you'd like to build it for maybe you have Commander Night on Fridays or at school. At your LGS as part of FNM. So you know maybe you're looking to pick them up as the week goes on so that you can build your deck for Friday. Someone like me, I'm looking at my cards when I can try and find them at their cheapest. So that means I'm looking for cards, particularly that rotated out of standard recently. So my focus is, yes, I'm interested in Throne of Eldraine, but I know I will come back and circle back to Throne of Eldraine eventually. I have a running list of cards from Guilds of Ravnica, which will be the cards that rotate out next fall, so in September or October, whenever rotation comes to pass. I will be looking for cards from Guilds of Ravnica for decks. But right now, the idea of grabbing cards from Guilds of Ravnica doesn't really appeal because many of them are probably more expensive than they really ought to be because they're being played in standard. But if they once they rotate out, the price usually comes down some, unless the card gets played in Pioneer or a Modern or some other format aside from just Commander. You had a great example there of a card that may not see a decrease in price particularly, Lux. What card was that we were talking about earlier? I've forgotten.
And we were talking about Teferi Time Raveler.
Oh, right. 3-mana Teferi for more of the spark. And, you know, we may be fortunate and see Teferi drop in price a little bit when he rotates out in the fall, but he is played very heavily right now in Pioneer and Modern, so his price may not drop very much. But some of those other Planeswalkers that aren't seeing a lot of play in Standard, I think are going to be kind of sleeper picks that are probably things that you could grab and they'd be nice and cheap right after rotation. And you'll pick up a bunch of those guys and sock them away in a deck.
And like you mentioned to me earlier in Starcon the Masterless.
Oh, yeah. I personally think he's going to be one of these sort of sneaky picks in for Commander players that if you have a Dragon sub-theme to your deck or you have a Planeswalker sub-theme to your deck, you're going to want a Starcon because, you know, if you have, let's imagine you have two or three Planeswalkers on the battlefield and you play him and then plus him, and all those Planeswalkers suddenly attack for a pile of damage, it won't take long for your opponents to be saying, boy, oh boy, I wish I wasn't dead. So, I think that is a strategy of right after rotation is a great time to pick up cards, particularly that aren't going to see play in Pioneer or other competitive formats. The other sort of option is sort of 6 to 8 weeks right after a set release. So like right now for Theros is when you should be grabbing Theros cards you want to play with. So if you have gods you want to put in your deck, so like Nylea or Purphoros or not Heliod, he's probably not a great example, but even Thassa, like these are the sorts of gods that you like cards you might be able to grab now when they're maybe a little bit cheaper. And because I bet come next fall, their price is going to be significantly more than it is right now. So I'd be looking to grab things from the most current set sort of 68 weeks after it released to try and catch them at their lowest point when there's lots of cards in the market, lots of people buying and selling them. So maybe the price is a little bit less. But by the time there's people stop drafting the format and stop opening packs regularly, then chances of you finding your card at a really sweet price is going to be significantly reduced than what it might be right now. Anything you want to add there, Lux, about when to buy your cards?
And I think you hit the nail on the head with that.
Thank you very much. So that sort of brings up the end of our talking about where to buy cards. So we're going to be moving on to reviewing Dragon's Maze. So we're moving to our second segment. And this week, we're looking back at Dragon's Maze, which is the third and final set from the Return to Ravnica block. And, okay, Sum this set up for me in one sentence, Lux.
Not worth the time or the money.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. This set was pretty much panned for being pretty poor. Now, it had a couple of like pretty significant barriers. Like, for starters, it was a small set. So Gatecrash and Return to Ravnica were both large sets, you know, close to 300 cards apiece. And the small set, Dragon's Maze, had a really hard time. Because while Return to Ravnica and Gatecrash were each representing 5 guilds, Dragon's Maze was trying to represent all 10. And it didn't really do it very well. You'd get a smattering of this, a smattering of that, and it really didn't do anything. So it really like had to do a lot to try and get the feel of like a Ravnica block set without really having many cards to do it in. So, you know, I will give the designers a little bit of a mulligan, but it's still kind of a lackluster set. The draft format, for anybody who may have remembered or may have forgotten, was one Return to Ravnica pack, one pack of Gatecrash, and one pack of Dragon's Maze, which means you have a big hodgepodge of stuff that you got to try and sift and make your deck out of. Now, I drafted this quite a bit at the time, and I found it lost a lot of consistency in your drafting. It was still fun. I wouldn't, you know, be rushing to do it again, though. And it wasn't always intuitive to play, like, what color combinations are you going to play? Because invariably, you almost had to play a 3-color deck if you were going to make it be something viable with just the number of playables and the number of cards that were pretty stinky PU. So it wasn't awesome. It was interesting. I remember the Pro Tour quite vividly and listening to commentary about how some of these cards were quite powerful. But I don't know. It's still something that makes me laugh today. Because it just leaves me wondering what is going on with this set. There really weren't a lot of competitive staples either, or cards that were particularly good. Obviously, the Shocklands all showed up in the set just to a lesser degree than they did with Return to Ravnica and Gatecrash. So that was a thing. But sort of the big notable cards, so you have Voice of Resurgence, which was played for a while quite prominently in Modern as a pretty strong 2-drop that you could cast. You could get value off of him if your opponent killed him. You could make all sorts of tokens with it. It was fine. It was a green bear, sort of green white hate bears deck, and there was a bit of an Abzan deck that was running around. Blood Baron of Viscopa was another one that was, was quite prominent in Standard, and maybe he's play in Pioneer as we go forward. But it's kind of expensive. It's a 5-mana card. But it's got a lot of text on it, so it makes it, you know, interesting enough to look at. Between the protection from some colors and gets +4/+4 as lifelink. So it's an interesting card, but it's not sure it's awesome. Wear and Tear probably is still the one that's most often talked about because it's, it provides a form of interaction for people who are looking to deal with mostly artifacts, I think, is the most common. There are a couple of common use here, but it's not something that is super prevalent anymore. And I'm not sure I've seen it in Pioneer yet. And we got Breaking and Entering was a fused card, another one that was sort of a thing for a hot minute in some sort of reanimator strategy. Hidden Strings is a combo card that, allows you to untap or tap things. And Notion Thief has flash and lets you steal cards. Legacy players like this one because nothing sounds more savage than stealing your opponent's brainstorm. So, well, let's read it just so you can get a funny appreciation for it. So, two blue and a black for a 3/1 human rogue. has flash, and if an opponent would draw a card except for the first one he or she draws in each of his or her draw steps, instead that player skips that draw and you draw a card. So they go to brain. So the funniest thing I think I've ever seen is that someone went to brainstorm, and then their opponent flashed in Notion Thief, and so instead of buddy with the brainstorm getting the cards, guy with the Notion Thief gets the cards instead. So that's pretty funny, but kind of mean all at the same time. So that's really all we have for like staples for constructed play. And then we had a whole bunch of commanders. Because the whole premise of the set was talking about having each of the guild had to send a maze runner to run the maze that existed to help solve the problem with the guild pack. There's 10 commanders to pick from for this set, which is a pretty good variety. The most popular being Rurik Thar, the Unbowed, which is like it's a very strong card. Lux, you ever played a Rurik Thar deck?
And I have not in myself, but I have seen it in my playgroups before.
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty deck. It really makes decks who are heavy focused on spells really think about if they want to be casting too many non-creature spells, because you know it doesn't take too many triggers before you're dead. He's got a big beefy body. He's got reach and vigilance. They're all good abilities. And he has a clause on them that makes it a little bit unfortunate, but you can work around. So the clause is he has to attack each turn. So it could be tricky to, attack each turn if able. So it's a little bit tricky to keep him alive because he often dies to bigger creatures, things with death touch, what have you. And then that adds to the commander tax. However, if you can, use him to convoke things or to crew vehicles, or give it maybe first strike or a piece of equipment like a Whisper Silk Cloak, or maybe make it evasive with a Rogue's Passage. Like, there you go. You found a way to work around the loophole, and you're going to put your opponents on a pretty good clock. He had 746 decks built, so he's pretty big. Varela the Hulkclade, we talked about last week with the Simic stuff. He's a pretty good commander for +1/+1 counter synergies. And at 3 CMC is pretty viable. So I think he's probably a little underrepresented at 515 decks. But let's be real, folks. Simic is not lacking for options these days. Simic just got some hot new tech in that Euro from Theros, and he's kind of crazy pants. So blue-green's not hurting for interesting commanders. Melek, is it Paragon? Have you ever seen a Melek deck go there, my friend?
And no, I have not.
No, I haven't either. And I seem to think it'd be pretty interesting. I think it has a lot of potential, but I think because I look at it and it reads to me like an experimental frenzy on steroids. That's what I look at. That's what I get from it. So it was like Melek says. So he's 4 blue-red for a 2/4 weird wizard. Play with the top card of your library revealed. You may cast the top card of your library if it's an instant or sorcery card. And whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell for your library, copy it. You may choose new targets for the copy. So if you're playing a pretty heavy spells and like spell slinging deck, then like this seems kind of insane to play cast things off the top of your deck just like Experimental Frenzy, and it copies it, which could be kind of nutty. This kind of feels very stormy and like a storm-esque deck. But I think it ran into problems because it's two things that hamper it. And I think 6 CMC, like 6 converted mana cost, Lux. Like, do you want to play a 6 mana commander, really?
No.
No, why not?
Yeah, mainly because when it comes to that, you also have to remember the commander tax. It increases every time your commander gets put back in the command zone.
Absolutely. So, you know, your 6 mana commander doesn't stay 6 mana for very long. It's 8 or 10 or 12 mana very quickly, and then it's really out of reach to play it and then take advantage of your commanders. So, you know, I tried very diligently to stay away from commanders that cost more than 5. Even 5 is sort of the upper echelon of how far I'm prepared to go. But yeah. And then the other hitch is that the Mizzix, which is another blue-red commander, which sort of does similar stuff to Melek, was printed in Commander 2015, and I'm pretty sure it's just a better deck. So, poor Melek gets only 488 decks. Mirko Vosk, I know you're a big Dimir fan there, Lux. Do you have any interest in playing a Mirko Vosk?
And actually, truth be told, I have never played him before.
No, and the reason you haven't played him, and I'm fairly convinced of this, is that he's a mill commander, for anybody who's curious. So, and the mill trigger on him is pretty nasty to get it going. So he's, you know, a 2/4, 5 mana, so 3 blue-black for a vampire. When he flies, so he's got evasion on him. And whenever Mirko Vosk, Mind Drinker, deals combat damage to a player, that player reveals cards at the top of his or her library until she reveals 4 lands, then puts those cards into his or her graveyard. Like, that's surprisingly potent. The only trick part is, like, it's a mill deck, and there are lots of better mill commanders that don't necessitate you to even deal combat damage to your opponents. So, like, he's not even the top 10 mill commanders, let alone, like, anything else. He's got 259 decks. He's interesting, I suppose, but not particularly exciting from any, you know, regard. Next is Varals. I've never seen one in the wild, but Lux brewed up a Varals deck, and I'm keen to see what it looks like in a bit. So we'll come back to this one. Tajik Blade of Legion, well, he's Boros, and he's crap. Sorry, folks, he's terrible. You're not going to want to play Tajik. So, good try. The 159 people who have brewed Tajik decks are clearly just trying to do something janky with them. You know, Aurelia from last week in Gatecrash would be a better Boros option. Taisa, Envoy of Ghosts. This one almost hurt my head to look at. There's 157 decks for this one, Lux. But really, 7 mana for a 4/4 creature? Like, come on. I'm out. I'm out already. Are you, like, is there anything about this card that even interests you?
No.
No. Like, I don't even think we're going to talk about it anymore. It's just not even a thing. The last one is Lavinia of the Tenth. Sorry, not true. There's couple more after. Lavinia of the Tenth. This card does not get a lot of love, but I think it actually is an underrated commander and probably should have more decks. But I'm going to be honest with you, it's a horrible, horrible feeling to cast this over and over and over again and watch your opponents have all their non-land permanents detained. So she's a 4/4 with protection for red for 5, a white, blue, and 3. And she has detain, which was the Azorius keyword from this particular set. So it contains all non-land permanents. So they can't use their mana rocks. They can't use small, cheap creatures. They can't use all of it. It just sits there useless. And, like, if you could find a way to recur her and get the trigger regularly, your opponents are just going to sit there and be furious with you. But it buys you lots of time to play and build your board up. So, like, I have it, and it's plays like a command, like a control deck. So I usually lend it out to somebody who's a control player, but it's surprisingly potent, and probably you know, people ought to be giving it a little more serious thought. Exava is awful. She is truly terrible with 52 decks because she plays on that keyword Unleash, which was only on Rakdos cards from the set. So if you're playing a Rakdos deck and they have the Unleash mechanic, yeah, like, there's not enough Rakdos cards to be relevant with Exava, Rakdos Blood Witch. So, you know, 53 decks seems like 53 decks too many. And then Amara Tandris. This showed up in Lux's deck 2 weeks ago in the 99. So she doesn't have a lot of decks, but she's still 7 mana for a 5/7, which is like really weird stats for, on an elf. Like, does that not seem out of proportions for you there, Lux? 7 mana, 5/7?
Yeah, and this right here is one of the main reasons why, instead of having her be a commander, I kept her in the 99.
Oh, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. And she doesn't really help you make tokens, so I don't really... So she protects your tokens, but doesn't help you make more. So she's probably not a great tokens commander. Now, I have heard some stories about the fact that... when we see Amara from Guilds of Ravnica, again, she's a 2/2. Which makes total sense. She's a 2/2, she makes tokens, she does exactly what Selesnya commanders want to do. But I think this variant of her, actually ended up having the card changed late in design, either because they wanted to do something else with it. I don't know what they did. I had heard some mention of the fact that maybe these should have been the stats on Voice of Resurgence, and Amara should have been on the other card. But anyway, it's fine in the end. It doesn't really matter. Either way, this is not a particularly great card to be building a commander deck around. So, as promised, we're going to move on to segment 3 here. Unless there's something you want to go back and revisit there, Lux. Anything we missed in talking about these 10 commanders?
And no, I think we covered the best about everything.
Probably more than we had to. So we're gonna come back to Lux's Veral deck, and which is actually a pretty cool build. I'm gonna turn it over to you, Lux. You can talk your way through the deck here, and what you sort of think. What were you thinking as you were going through this deck? And what's sort of the game plan? What if you were gonna pilot this deck? What do you want to do with this to make this interesting?
Well, for starters, Veral's in, he works around the graveyard strategy, known like the scavenge mechanic.
And okay, could you read Veral's for everybody so everyone knows exactly what you're talking about?
And for one green and one black, you get a legendary creature troll warrior, 2/2. Each creature in your graveyard has scavenge. The scavenge cost is equal to its mana cost. And what scavenge is, for those that don't know, is exile a creature card from your graveyard and pay its mana cost, and you put a number of 1/1 counters equal to that card's power on a target creature.
That's pretty cool. And then, of course, at the bottom, there's a sacrifice another creature, regenerate Veral's Scarstripe. So he's got a measure of protection built on him, too, which I think is pretty good, so that you don't lose all your counters if you put them on Veral's. So, I'm looking at your deck list here. This looks pretty spicy. What do you got here? What do you go talk us through this?
Well, one notable card that I'm pretty sure everybody remember that's played the Return of Ravnica, Deadbridge Goliath.
So Deadbridge Goliath is one of these things that I think a lot of people overlooked. And then start looking back at big fatties for a deck just like this, and this is exactly the sort of card you want to play. So he's 5/5 for 4 mana, and he already has a scavenge mechanic ability on it. So if you don't have Veral's in play, you can still scavenge this guy onto another card. So that's pretty cool. 5/5 for 4 is probably, it's a pretty good rate of return for a big green beater, and that when it dies, you can then turn it into more +1/+1 counters to smash face. So yeah, that's sort of like a pretty good baseline for that for this deck. Keep going. What else did you find in here?
And going along with the 1/1 counters, and another really helpful card that could help build up your ramp up your creatures is Corpse Jack Menace.
Oh yeah. So this one is a big one. Anybody playing with +1/+1 counters that has access to black and green, you want Corpse Jack Menace in your deck because it's just going to be a house. If it's so 2 black green, 4/4 creature fungus, if one or more +1/+1 counters will be put on a creature you control, twice that many plus encounters are put on instead. So that is that's huge, right? That doubles your counters. So if you have, of course, Jack Menace on Deadbridge Goliath, puts 10 counters on something instead of just 5. So, good heavens. All right, keep going. What else you got on this list? There's lots of good treats on this one.
And moving away from creatures and the spells, there are some spells in this deck that go along with in like the 1/1 counters. And one like an example is Inspiring Call, a card I'm sure you're familiar with.
Well, I'm familiar with it, and it's a super card for plus encounters. Because if you have a 3, 4, 5 creatures on the battlefield with some plus encounters on it, you then get to for 2 and a green, you draw a card for each creature with a plus encounter on it. So you draw some cards, and then they all get indestructible until end of turn. And so that could be an awesome combat trick to protect you from a board wipe, or if you attack and your opponent surprises you with something, now you have a way to protect your creatures. There's just lots of interesting things you can do with it. And it's, it's 47 cents as an uncommon. I've seen a couple of printings. Like, there's still a pretty good price on the card, which means it's probably a pretty good card. So, I think Inspiring Call is a great inclusion in this deck and kind of essential unless you're looking to get yourself board wiped over and over and over again. What else you got there, Lux?
And continuing on with the spells, and there's one that's it's basically a functional reprint of Corpse Strike Menace, but it's cheaper in mana cost, and it's harder to get rid of. Hardened Scales.
Hardened Scales is a good one. Also, I think you guys saw a Winding Constrictor in the deck. Both all these sort of play on the same theme of increasing the number of +1/+1 encounters on your creatures. And if these are allowed to get out of control, then you could find yourself just running away with the game. Likely, your opponents are going to be wise to this fact, and they're going to kill these things pretty promptly. So there are some interesting ways to get some cards back out of your graveyard, I noticed. So you can use like a Grapple with the Past to get something back. You have a Nyx Weaver that has the ability to get a card from your graveyard and put it back in your hand. So there's some ways to get things back from your graveyard, which is highly appealing. You could use Deadbridge Chant, which is another one of your enchantments that could allow you to get it back. So there's a lot of interesting things here. I have to say, like looking at this, like this looks like a pretty sweet deck. What else are some highlights here there, Lux?
Now, like when it comes to multicolor decks, and I think like one of the best things that we ever gotten from Return to Ravnica, this is literally the cornerstone of every single and multicolor deck, Chromatic Lantern.
Yeah, like this is sort of a sort of card that I saw it, and I'm like, does this deck really truly need a Chromatic Lantern? But why would you not play it? I mean, there might be another. There are fewer 2-mana rocks than I like, and I really would really like a 2-mana rock in this place instead of a 3-mana rock. But if you have to get a 3-mana rock, you can't really do much better than Chromatic Lantern. There are other options, but it's very good. It fixes your mana. It means you don't really have to worry about whether you're tapping black or green. It just makes sure that you can do whatever you want. So it's really good. The other two rocks are like the Locket and the Signet, which are just useful cards for this. As I was telling you earlier, I think we're going to get good mileage out of these sorts of cards for all these decks we brew, because I think they're sort of budget inclusions that go in almost everything. I'm looking at this and this looks pretty. You've got some cool ways to put counters on stuff. You've got some ways to fill the graveyard. So when I was sort of looking at your list there, Lux, I sort of broke your things down again, as I usually do. So your ramp package, you have a couple of different elves, Llanowar elves, Elvish Mystic. You have Deathcap Cultivator. These also all work together to help you power out your big creatures or help you pay your scavenge costs. I put World Shaper on this because you have a lot of ways to fill your graveyard and dump extra land in your graveyard. And you can use World Shaper's trigger to pull a lot of things out of it. Again, the Locket, the Clue Stone, the Chromatic Lantern are all, you know, good sources of ramp. So you've got, you know, 7 or 8 sources. So you're not doing too badly. Your card draw, you have Rishkar's Expertise, Izoni, Locket and Clue Stone again, Gerard's Order, Villis, Guardian Project. You've got lots of ways to draw you cards out of all this. And then this sort of deck needs some enablers to dump things in your graveyard and to dump them in there for cheap. So Satyr Wayfinder is an all-star in this sort of deck. Grizzly Salvage, Commune with the Gods. Nyx Weaver fills the graveyard nicely. Doom Whisperer is one from Guilds of Ravnica that is going to be fantastic in this sort of deck. With that Surveil ability, you can, you know, dump a bunch of cards in your graveyard to filter out exactly what you want to have on top of your deck. And in the process, giving your Varals fuel to start the scavenge game and to make your threat that's going, or threats that is going to be, you know, what wrecks your opponent. And then I looked at your heavy hitters, and I agree. Corp Deck Menace was a huge menace. Doom Whisperer fits in the same category, like 6/6 flying with Trample. Like, that's really good. Hogak, I noticed you slipped the Hogak in there, for that's good measure. Rotting Regisaur is another one. I think it's a, you know, a big body that's going to help you close out a game. Pardon me. And then A Life's Legacy, I think, is actually probably very impactful in this sort of deck because it acts as a free sacrifice outlet to kill, to have your big thing die instead of just dying for no value. So if somebody board wipes, or if somebody, kills your Deadbridge Goliath, you can sacrifice it in response to draw the cards, and, you know, you're laughing at the end of the day. So, I have to say, like, I thought this deck was pretty spicy. Lots of really interesting things. Your removal package is exactly what I sort of figured a green-black deck would run. Without going into too many of the expensive options, like the Murderous Riders or the, you know, whatever else. What do you think there, Lux? What do you think here?
And all in all, it's really in flavor with and the in color combo, the Golgari. Think of the deck as an engine.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I think that the whole deck, like, all of it plays so well together that you're going to get lots of opportunity to do sort of what the Golgari were supposed to do in this block, which was to go and use creatures in the graveyard to make humongous threats and attack for a pile. I have to say, just like last week, the inclusion of Karn's Bastion as a utility land in your mana base, I think, is going to be huge for getting extra proliferate triggers and really taking those +1/+1 counters from being just big into being enormous and letting you close out a game that much faster. So, yeah, like, you did pretty good, and you're like right on the $100 mark, like just a spot on $100, and somebody gets a deck with a lot of flexibility, a lot of play, all the removal they could ever want, and some ways to close out a game in pretty good order. So I have to applaud you here, Lux. I think you did a great job here brewing a deck. Yeah, any last thoughts about your deck before we move to sort of wrap the show up this week?
Yeah, when it comes to the budget, and I think we could have done better, but I think we, like you said, we have a really solid deck here, but once the players have something to go off of, and like they have the base to start on, they can build up the money and they can go look for better staples for the deck.
Absolutely. As we've said before, these decks are just really all about giving us the framework for your deck without, you know, having to break the budget. But it's not like, you know, going to put you in contention to play super, super expensive, you know, commander, because people are going to say, hey, geez, man, like I can go and find so many better decks or better cards or better this, or that, but it costs them a whole lot more. This gets them in the door, gets them something fun they can play and build, and, you know, and sure enough, you know, you're going to be in the game playing, and hopefully you'll be able to sneak a win or two and upgrade your deck as you go. That's part of the fun of Commander, is tinkering with your decks and taking out that, you know, colossal Dreadmaw and putting in something else, where we know full well the colossal Dreadmaw there is because of budgetary restraints. Like, he's a 5-cent card, and, you know, maybe that's exactly what you need. But anyway, yeah, I think you did a great job here, my friend. You did a terrific job. So we're going to move to sign off, I think, then, Lux, unless there's anything else you want to bring up. Anything else?
No.
All right. So that just pretty much wraps up this week's show. I just still can't believe how quickly they whiz by. Every week, show goes by in a blink of an eye. And I hope you enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun for us. I really enjoyed this week's talk. Lux, I always love sitting down and having a chat with you. Get your perspective on things from so far away. I mean, it's amazing in this day and age that a guy in snowy Canada can talk to a dude in Texas, and we can all talk Commander and have a great old time. So if you want to leave us some feedback, our social media coordinates are, if you want to email us, we're at theepicexperimentpodcast@gmail.com. So that's theepicexperimentpodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Or you can find us on Twitter at @EXPcast, or you can find us on Moxfield at the Epic Experiment Podcast. That's our username. Follow us there, so you can see everything we build. I have to admit, I've been pretty busy the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 days since we last recorded, because my wife and I have opened a new small business here in our town, and I haven't been able to put the deck list up on exoticmtg.com. They have been gracious enough to let us host our and put our podcast, our decks up on their deck tech section. So if you're interested in checking out Exotic MTG and their deck techs, please go and check them out. We'll find the commander, the deck tech tab, and find our commander decks that are all going to be there. Next week, we're going to be looking at, we have a couple of interesting options, because in the calendar of Magic back in 2013 was when Modern Masters 2013 came out, so the very first Modern Masters and the very first Super Tournament in Las Vegas, which everyone still raves about today. But we're not going to talk too much about Modern Masters because it's mostly a reprint set. Core 2014 had zero commanders in it, so we're not going to talk about it too much. So that leads us very quickly into Theros. Pardon me. So next week, we'll be going over Theros together. So that'll be a lot of fun. I've already started brewing a deck. Hopefully it's kind of spicy. So stop in any of our social media comments. If you have any suggestions about the deck, ask a question, leave a comment, or just reach out and say hi. We'd love to hear from you. So until then, this is the Epic Experiment Podcast signing off. Wishing you all the best wherever you next play Magic.